Good morning. My name is Lainey Rutko. I'm an assistant professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Thank you so much for being here. An 8:30 a.m. session on the last day of a conference is a challenge. And I want to give an extra big thank you to anyone who's here because your flight out was canceled. So when I saw the program for this year's APHA meeting, I was incredibly excited when I realized that I would be presenting to food and nutrition on the day that accounts for the highest per capita consumption of sugar in the U.S., which is to say, Happy Halloween. Before I begin, I wanted to just quickly acknowledge my co-authors on this presentation. You can see their names are on this slide. One is Jennifer Pomerantz, the other is Sarah Rodman, and I'd also like to thank the Center for a Livable Future, which provided support for some of the work that I'm going to discuss today. And I have no relationships to disclose. Before I get into the specifics of front of package labeling and food advertising, I wanted to just step back for a moment to provide you with some background information about the bigger context of law and food manufacturers, or some people would say food industry. So just to make sure that we're all kind of using the same terms and on the same page here, when I talk about law, I'm referring to legislation, regulation, and litigation. So those kind of three core areas of law. And we can be talking about legal activity that's happening at either the federal level, the state level, or the local level. And it turns out that in the areas that we'll be talking about today, all three of those levels of government are important players. Relative to food, laws can do a host of things. And this slide just gives you a brief sample. So laws can provide taxation of certain food products. Maybe food products that we're trying to discourage people from purchasing, like sugar-sweetened beverages. They also can determine where food manufacturers are located, both around the country, perhaps in states that have laws that are more favorable to business, but then also within municipalities due to zoning laws. Laws can determine the conditions under which food is produced, and there we're thinking about things like food safety and spot inspections. And finally, in these last few points are things that I'll be discussing directly today. Laws clearly impact how foods are advertised and promoted, what, if any, information is required to be displayed about foods, particularly relative to nutritional content. And finally, laws determine who has regulatory authority over food. And there, again, we're talking about different agencies, but also between the state, federal, and local government, who actually has authority to regulate. And as with any industry, the food industry has a variety of ways that it can choose to participate in the regulatory process. And so, as with the last slide, this list is not meant to be exhaustive at all, but to give you a flavor of the different ways that the industry can participate, food industry representatives can provide testimony at hearings. They can certainly engage in lobbying activities, and they're typically well-funded to do that. They can give briefings. I'm sure you've all heard about congressional briefings being given, or maybe less formal briefings being given to staffers. They can provide representatives to serve on advisory panels on a host of issues that might only tangentially touch the food industry. They can also do things that we hear less about. So for example, food industry groups will sometimes draft what's called model legal language, and that's sample legal language, and they will then go to a state legislator and say, this is the type of bill that we would like to see introduced this year. And we know that that happens because if you go onto industry websites, particularly, say, your state restaurant association, you'll see press releases about exactly that kind of activity, and that's entirely legal for them to do. The food industry will also do things like draft voluntary pledges for other members of the food industry to sign on to. Food industry can initiate litigation when it feels that it has been subject to a legal wrong. And finally, members of the food industry can submit comments during the notice and comment process when a proposed regulation is shared with the public. Now, this question will seem very obvious to many of you, which is, so why does the food industry do all of these things? Why is it so actively participating in the regulatory process? And the very simple answer is because it wants to create a legal environment that's favorable to it and that promotes its interests. So Let's talk about exactly what that favorable legal environment might look like. And here, I want to distinguish between self-regulation and governmental regulation. You'll see on the left-hand side of the slide, and I should say these are kind of broad brushstrokes. There are, of course, exceptions to these categories. But in general, government regulation is legally binding. So if the industry is regulated by the government, it's required to comply with those regulations. If something's legally binding, that typically means that it also can be enforced by the government. And finally, in general, when the government acts, either through legislation or regulation, there's public participation in that process. And that can mean through hearings or through things like the notice and comment period. Now, on the other side of this slide, you'll see information about self-regulation. And this is a very different landscape from governmental regulation. Typically, self-regulation is voluntary. So that means that in the food industry, several companies or perhaps a trade association will get together and say, you know, why don't we draft a pledge about food advertising to kids? And we'll all sign on to that pledge, but we're going to draft the language and we're going to control what happens with it. If something is voluntary like that, clearly it's not enforceable because there's no government agency that's charged with enforcing that pledge. It's an industry-generated initiative. That generally also means that there's not a reporting requirement associated with it. And in many cases, the food industry will hope that if it puts forth that kind of self-regulatory pledge, it will replace government regulation. So if the government sees that the food industry is taking action to kind of regulate itself voluntarily, industry will often hope that that means the government will kind of back off and not feel pressured to step in and create legally binding regulation. And I put this scale at the bottom of the slide just to remind us that it's really kind of a balancing act, because most of the time we don't want to live in a place where everything is strictly regulated by the government all the time. And I would argue we also don't want to live in a place where nothing is regulated by the government. So it's really a balancing act. So I'm going to talk about two key things in this presentation. Now, the first is front of package labeling in the legal environment, and the second is food advertising to children. Okay, so to start off with front of package labeling, what is it exactly? I'm sure that you have all picked up a package, flipped it over onto its side, and you've seen that label. Right? In fact, it's sort of hard to remember a time when that label didn't exist. This is not a front of package label. This is the nutrition facts panel that is required to be on all food products. And as I said, it's on the side of the package, so you have to physically pick up the package, flip it over to see this information. And I bet, can you just nod? I'm sure this looks familiar to many of you, right? Good. Okay, some of you are even awake. Thank you, it's nice to see you. Now, what about front of package labeling? So this is kind of a different universe. And again, I'm sure it's very familiar to all of you because the last time that you were in a grocery store, you walked down the aisle, and I'm sure a bunch of these labels caught your eye, and I'm going to show you some examples in a second. But these are labels that are easy to see. You don't have to pick anything up because they're right there on the front of the package. Are they easy to understand? Not necessarily, and I'll give you some examples of that. And interestingly, particularly for this presentation, front of package labeling in this country is largely unregulated right now. So here are a couple of examples. The label at the and again, these are all things that you'll see on the front of a package. I'm sure these look familiar to a lot of you. At the top of the screen, you'll see a lot of information, but I bet you can also find things that are missing. So, example, this says that the item that it's on per serving contains 450 calories. So I have a few questions when I see that, like how many servings are in this item? You know, because if it's a huge box, then how much am I really going to be eating and getting 450 calories? And also, if, say, I don't know how many calories I'm supposed to eat per day, which a lot of folks don't, then just 450 calories isn't going to mean a whole lot to me when I'm thinking about my food choices and purchasing decisions. And then if you move down to the green label, so again, you're given a couple of words as a sensible solution. Okay, that's nice. Again, not sure exactly what that means. Low in sodium, low in calories, but no specifics are given. So again, we don't have a lot of information to work with. And then finally, the American Heart Association checkmark, it's a reputable organization. It's one that we've all heard of. You know, I think that one's on my oatmeal, but I don't really know exactly what it means. I guess it means that there's some part of it that's supposed to be heart healthy or good for me. But you get the idea here, right? Like you can't really, these labels, they're interesting. Maybe they encourage us to make certain purchases or not make certain purchases, but we really don't get a lot of clear information. So here's what's going on right now with the legal environment relative to front of package labeling. And a lot of people call it FOP or front of pack. Because of the proliferation of these types, and these are all industry-generated labels, the federal government asked the Institute of Medicine to look into this issue of front-of-pack labeling with the ultimate goal of putting together a uniform, evidence-based front-of-package system that would be used in the United States. And so most of us, from a legal perspective, and I would say from a food policy perspective, that's a good thing, right? We want this to be easy to understand and based on evidence as opposed to just, you know, a check mark that doesn't necessarily have any evidence base behind it. In 2010 and 2011, the IOM put out related reports about front-of-package labeling. These are publicly available. They're very easy to get if you just Google IOM and front-of-pack. And they did exactly what they were asked to do. They looked at what was out there. They provided lots of information about the evidence base or lack of evidence base. So when I submitted this abstract, which was a long time ago now, I hoped that the bottom of this slide would be more interesting than it is, but it turns out that there has still not been any action taken from FDA relative to the IOM report. So they're out there, FDA says that it's working on this issue, but there's not a whole lot that's happened. And for most front-of-pack programs, they haven't been evaluated, so we really don't know if they're scientifically sound. There's one program, Smart Choices, which I bet is familiar to some of you. That program has been evaluated against a validated nutrition index, and it was found that most of the foods that received the Smart Choices kind of good-for-you front-of-pack label actually did not align well with this validated nutrition index. And so that maybe that's representative of what's going on with front-of-pack labeling. Maybe it's not. We just don't know because the studies haven't been done. And finally, do we as consumers understand this information well? You know, I gave you my take on it, and I would, you know, I'm a public health lawyer who does food policy, so I would say I'm a relatively informed consumer in this area, and I still couldn't tell you for sure what a lot of these labels mean. So the unfortunate news is that legally we're still in a largely unregulated environment relative to front of pack. Okay, now I'm going to just quickly move on to food advertising and kids. So is this an issue? Anyone here who is a parent or who has ever interacted with a child, I think, has noticed that advertising has a huge impact on what children like, particularly what they like to eat. And study after study after study has documented that there is a direct correlation between exposure to food advertising and children's food and dietary preferences. We're not the only ones who think so. The food companies spend about $2 billion a year advertising food to children. So I would say they're also pretty thoroughly convinced that advertising works. This quote at the bottom of the slide is from an IOM report that was released in 2006 that looked at food marketing to children. And by the way, for those of you who are interested, there's an update in the works on this report, and there's going to be an IOM workshop in November of this year to begin the process of working on that update. And you can just see from the quote that it's telling us what we already know. Food and beverage advertising practices for youth are really out of balance with a healthy eating environment. So in response to those types of concerns, in 2009, Congress created the Interagency Working Group on Foods Marketed to Children. A lot of people call this the Interagency Working Group, or the IWG. Folks had very high hopes for it when it was created. I remember it was an exciting time in food policy, and you can see that it included representation from the FDA, from the Federal Trade Commission, CDC, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So all of the main players at the federal level in food policy and regulation. This group had a simple charge, which was to create recommendations to help the government develop voluntary guidelines for food advertising to kids. What I want to highlight here is that this group was never supposed to do anything that had legally binding effect. They were asked to put together recommendations to inform voluntary, non-binding guidance. And you can see a sample of what they came back with in April 2011. This was not terribly controversial stuff. I'm running out of time, so I'm going to go quickly through these last two slides, which is just the gist of the story is that an industry-backed group called the Children's Food and Beverage Advertising Initiative immediately came back with its own set of recommendations after the federal, again, voluntary recommendations were released. The industry-backed side put up a lot of arguments to challenge what the feds had suggested for these voluntary guidelines, and it became quite contentious last summer. Some of you may remember this. It got a lot of media coverage. I'm wrapping up. So again, I can talk about this quickly, unfortunately, because the story now is that after a lot of industry pushback, the recommendations from the interagency working group have not moved forward, and the effort is, I was originally going to say stalled, but then I upgraded it to just say ended, because that's really the truth. Okay, and this is my last slide, so I'm going to go very quickly, but if folks want to talk about this more in the Q&A, I'm happy to. I don't like to present problems and not give solutions, so this is just a sample of the kinds of ways in which we as public health professionals can be involved in the food regulatory process, and I want to emphasize you do not have to be a lawyer or a public health lawyer to do most of these things. Okay, so I will stop there, and I'm very happy to take questions. Should I do questions now? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. I'm very happy to take questions right now. thank you. In the back? Yeah, no, so thank you for that comment. And basically, the gist of what you were saying is that there's activity going on, but FDA is saying again, as it has been saying, that we're going to wait and see. I mean, that's kind of the gist of what you were saying. And I actually spoke to a bunch of my friends who were in different parts of the food policy world in anticipation of doing this presentation because I thought, oh, maybe there's some secret behind-the-scenes thing going on with Front of Pack that I could then publicly tell you about. But your information is the same as the information that I got back, that FDA's official position on this is that we're just going to keep waiting and seeing, which is unfortunate because they already have these two IOM reports, and we keep seeing more and more of these industry-generated front-of-pack initiatives. And I should just say, too, I don't think that our default assumption should be that industry-generated front-of-pack is bad, but we don't know if it's good. So we have to have a healthy skepticism about it. Any other questions? It's okay. It's very early, and I'm first. I understand. I'm sorry. Did you have a question? Or no, you were just moving. Understood. Okay. Well, thank you very much, and I'll be sticking around afterwards if anyone wants to talk more.